The debate over asylum seekers, particularly from Central America, has been focused on whether or not they deserve to stay in the United States. But there's been a largely overlooked wrinkle in the story. Thousands aren't defending their cases in court because they're not showing up. Julia Preston, a contributing writer to the Marshall Project, recently wrote about this phenomenon. Her story, published in conjunction with the Washington Post, is Fearful of Court, Asylum Seekers Are Banished in Absentia. And I'm very pleased to welcome Julia Preston back to our show. Good to see you again.
It's nice to see you.
What percentage of asylum seekers is failing to show up in court?
Of the families who came across the border after 2014 in that big surge that came across the border at that time and since then, 70% of those asylum cases are ending with immigration judges issuing deportation orders to empty courtrooms. The people are not showing up for their hearings.
And do we know the main reasons why?
I think it's a combination of things. It has a lot to do with the fact that they've had a very hard time finding lawyers. These are asylum cases. They're very hard, complex cases. The law is adverse to these cases in many instances. And without a lawyer, a Central American family has a very remote chance of making a successful argument before an immigration judge. But there's also a great deal of fear out there now. Under the Trump administration, Immigration and Customs Enforcement has been going not to immigration courts, but to other courts, state courts, traffic courts, family courts, and arresting people. And people are now afraid to turn up in court. They think they'll be deported that same day.
Even though you say ICE agents don't come to the asylum courts?
They don't tend to go to the immigration courts. But for Central American family or someone who's an asylum seeker, making those distinctions between a federal court and a criminal court and an immigration court, that's hard even for Americans to understand.
How do judges typically rule in these asylum cases when the asylum seeker is choosing to show up in court?
It depends a lot. It varies a lot from court to court. So you have, for example, here in New York, in Los Angeles, in Chicago, you have a large number of judges, and some of them are quite favorable to these kinds of cases. We have to remember that these families are coming from Central American countries, two of which were candidates for the most number of homicides in the world in the past 2 years. So these are not frivolous cases. These families have real claims.
They're escaping gang violence in some cases, but also, as we have seen in El Salvador, genocide.
Well, the big problem that they have now is the uncontrolled spread of the influence of criminal gangs. These are predatory gangs that basically live from extortion. And there are places in Honduras and El Salvador where the central government or the city government is not in power, where these gangs have actually taken power.
Did that have much of an impact while Barack Obama was president? Wasn't he labeled the deporter in chief?
This problem that's culminating today started with the Obama administration. The Obama administration, when these families started turning up at the border and turning themselves into the Border Patrol and asking for asylum, the Obama administration at first just tried to deport them very quickly and didn't succeed in that because they were blocked by the courts. And
What do the laws say about somebody who says, I'm seeking asylum because my life is in danger back home?
That initiates a process that goes through immigration court. And the person will pass an initial test, whether their fears are credible, and then they can go out to courts around the country and defend their cases. The problem has been that there are a number of immigration courts around the country where these cases are not seen favorably by judges, and the judges just don't believe that a gang-related case should be grounds for asylum. And so particularly the court that I went to, which was in Charlotte, North Carolina, the judges have a very tough view of these cases, and a lot of them are failing.
you wrote about Judge V. Stewart Couch, who oversees asylum cases in Charlotte, North Carolina. What is his view on migrants from Central America who apply for asylum?
He interprets the law that it simply is that asylum is not available for cases related to criminal violence. So he would see the law as being more traditionally people who are fleeing persecution for religion or nationality or race or politics. And, you know, I'm not to say that he's wrong. It's just that there's a wide variety of opinion. And so in some cases, in some courts, people have a much better chance than in others. But in any court, if you don't have a lawyer, these cases are just almost impossible to make.
Well, how does he make that distinction between whether somebody's life is in danger because of one thing rather than another?
Because the people will argue their cases if they're allowed to articulate them, but you really need a lawyer to explain how a mother who's afraid that her son is going to be murdered by a gang if he doesn't join, or that their teenage daughter is going to be raped by a gang member if the family is not compliant. You need a lawyer to explain how to make that fit into our asylum laws.
What do immigration lawyers say about Judge Couch's manner in the courtroom?
Well, they are very intimidated by his manner. He runs, as I said in my article, he runs a very strict courtroom, and he doesn't make it easy for the lawyers, even the ones that do turn up. So, but I think it's important to note that in immigration court, no one has a right to counsel paid by the government. So this is very different from the other courts in the country, where if you have a criminal charge, the government, and you can't afford a lawyer, the government will help you get one. This is not true in immigration court, and this is part of the reason why you're seeing this massive failure of these cases.
Well, in the cases where there are lawyers, how does he make it difficult for them?
Well, Judge Couch, and there's another judge in that court, they're just very strict. They are they're impatient with the lawyers. If the people don't turn up, there was one case of a guy who went to Charleston instead of Charlotte and, you know, came running into the courtroom because he was just confused about where the court was supposed to be. And they're you know, quite strict about the paperwork. And we're talking about courts that in which the clerks, for example, are tremendously overburdened. It's a very hard job to be a clerk in an immigration court. So there are constant problems with papers getting lost or documents displaced or misplaced for one reason or another. And some of the judges have very little patience with that.
My guest is Julia Preston, who is a contributing writer to the Marshall Project and who has just published a story with the Marshall Project in conjunction with the Washington Post called Fearful of Court, Asylum Seekers Are Banished in Absentia. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Are there any groups or organizations that are working to try to get these asylum seekers to show up in court?
Well, there have been studies that have shown that when people do have lawyers, and particularly this group of people, the asylum seekers from Central America and other recent cases, if they do have lawyers, they do show up. It's much higher percentage of people that show up if there's a lawyer. So,
but they have to find a pro bono lawyer. How do you
find
one?
Or you have to be able to raise money to pay for a lawyer. And in particular in the Carolinas, which was where I was reporting this story, there are currently no organizations that are providing pro bono services for asylum cases for adults. And so that gives you an idea of how severe the shortage is.
What would a lawyer cost for a case like that?
Probably about $5,000. If the people have an opportunity to work and save, they will pay. And they're not all indigent people, but they can't work, actually, when they first start the case. And so there's a complication there as well.
And even if they have a competent lawyer, what are their chances?
It depends from court to court. But in the court that I saw in Charlotte, if you go before Judge Couch, for example, you have about a 15% chance of winning your case. So it's a dilemma. It's a terrible dilemma.
15%, that's not very high.
No, it's not.
And then, as we've heard on reports on WMIC, there are some unscrupulous people in this field.
Yes, that's right. And there have been, In Charlotte, there were people who took advantage of immigrants and asylum seekers in years past and tried to convince them that they could win their cases, and that antagonized the judges even more. And so there's a history of abuse as well by the lawyers in that court.
If the asylum seeker doesn't have access to legal services, is there any chance that they can still gain asylum status?
It's almost zero. Almost zero. Really, it's very difficult for those particular people to understand how they have to frame their case to be consistent with the law. It's almost zero.
And then we have women now fleeing domestic violence who are making a case for asylum. Are the courts sympathetic to that?
Well, the courts are sympathetic more to that because there have been a series of cases in recent years where domestic violence victims in extreme cases have been able to be recognized as asylum seekers by the court. So there is actual jurisprudence that supports that.
Now, the people are coming across at the Mexican border. Do they have to be vetted at the border?
They are vetted at the border. Almost more than 80% of the people who do pass an initial interview at the border of these Central American families, they pass that test.
Are the arguments different than they are for Mexicans because so many of the Central American immigrants face serious dangers in their homeland?
The arguments are different for Mexicans for a number of reasons. The administrations, past administration, the current administration, very reluctant to recognize that there might be a legitimate asylum claim from Mexico. And also Mexicans, because their country is a neighboring country, they are subjected to much quicker deportation procedures. It's much harder for them to gain a foothold in the court system.
You mentioned a precedent for domestic violence. Would that apply everywhere, or would that just be something that certain courts would recognize but not others?
No, this is federal law. These are federal rulings in the immigration court. So now, ironically, a woman who has been severely beaten by her husband has a better chance of gaining asylum in the United States than a woman whose husband was murdered by a gang or who was threatened with murder by a gang.
Or whose kids are threatened. Isn't another reason that many of these asylum seekers never make it to court just clerical, where they never even receive the notice?
Yes, because you have in these enormous backlogs in the immigration court, I think the number is over 600,000 cases in the backlog now. So it's years of backlogs. And in Charlotte, for example, the court that I looked at, you had 8,000 cases and four judges. So this is take them a long time. And the result of that is that there's constant confusion on the docket and the clerk. It's an entirely paper system. It's this great sort of Kafkaesque paper system where the clerks are running around the hallways trying to make sure that they have the right paper folder in the right place at the right time.
Have the courts been more lenient in those cases when they realize that they're the ones who made the mistake?
No, it's not. That has not been a basis for appeal, I don't think.
Have you spoken to any of the asylum seekers? Is it widely known in that community that failure to show up in court automatically will lead to a deportation ruling?
I think there's a feeling in the community around that court that they're uncertain as to which is worse, going to court or not going to court, which is, I think, a sign of failure of the court system. People should have confidence that they have an opportunity for justice. Not all these cases are going to succeed. There are, in this, you know, among these asylum seekers, there are people who just wanted a better life. You know, they were economic migrants. Not all the cases will succeed. But when you have a widespread feeling in the community that their cases are not going to succeed and that there's no opportunity for justice, then that's a sign of failure in the courts.
And the hope of the asylum seeker is that if I just live here illegally, I might be able to slip through.
Well, the problem with that now is that the Trump administration has changed the priorities that prevailed under President Obama. So now with President Trump, We no longer have Immigration and Customs Enforcement making distinctions between people that have criminal records or pose a serious threat to public safety and others who are just recent border crossers or families who were asylum seekers who didn't succeed in court. So now,
well, if they were vetted at the border, wouldn't that suggest that they were allowed in for a reason?
Well, there's also a process that you go through when you're seeking asylum where you do have to pass a criminal background check, and that's part of the process. But basically, since these families have orders of removal now and their most recent addresses are part of the court record, they can be subject to deportation at any time, and it's quite likely that Immigration and Customs Enforcement will pursue those cases.
My guest is Julia Preston, who is now a contributing writer to the Marshall Project. She wrote Fearful of Court, Asylum Seekers Are Banished in Absentia, and that was published in conjunction with the Washington Post. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Julia Preston, who is a contributing writer to the Marshall Project. Her article, published in conjunction with the Washington Post, that we are discussing is Fearful of Court, Asylum Seekers Are Banished in Absentia. Is there any way to legally fight or appeal an order of removal?
Well, in some of these cases, will be an opportunity for lawyers to request to reopen the case. There is a final opportunity there, but again, you need to have a lawyer who really knows what they're doing to do it. Once you get to the stage of having a judge issue an order of deportation or an order of removal, that's very serious.
Is part of the problem that it's really difficult to prove that my life is in danger in this village in Honduras?
No, actually, that's not the problem, because the requirements for evidence in an asylum case are not that difficult if the person knows what they need. You need to be able to show that you were part of a particular social group of people who were affected in a similar way by the threat of violence. So it's not enough to just say, this gang member tried to kill me. It should be. It sounds like it should be, but in fact, that's not enough for the court. You need to show that there were other people in a similar situation than that you're part of that group of people. And so this is why it's very demanding legal argument and really needs an experienced lawyer to make it.
I'm assuming there are other problems. For example, many of the people involved are working if they have jobs at all, working at very low wage jobs, which means it would be difficult to take the day off. They often don't have driver's licenses, so it's hard for them to get to the court.
That's exactly right. And there's a catch-22 in the law, which is an asylum seeker is entitled to a work permit after 6 months that the case has been before the court. So in the period of time when you need to be getting a lawyer and preparing your case, you can't work. And then by the time you get your work permit, in a lot of cases, your argument is already advanced in the court. So there is a kind of a catch-22 there that the immigrants say, well, I don't get this. I'd love to be able to work so I could pay for a lawyer, but I can't work legally. If I work illegally, then they're definitely going to throw me out of the country.
Now, you mentioned that you checked out courts in North Carolina. Are there certain areas in the country where there are more concentrations of the people we're talking about?
Here in New York, for example, Chicago, Los Angeles, but they really have gone all over the country. What happened at the border was that they were sent to be with a relative or somebody who would sponsor them in a local court. And of course, in North Carolina, there are lots of factories and agricultural, farms and that kind of thing. And so there have been traditionally a large number of immigrants, especially from Central America, have gone to that region.
Are there certain places where the judges tend to be harder on asylum seekers than others?
Well, the most famous court in the country at this point is in Atlanta, Georgia. You really don't want to end up in Atlanta, Georgia, if you're an asylum seeker.
I probably just don't want to go to Atlanta, Georgia, unless I'm a filmmaker. Right now, that's the hottest area for making movies in America.
Uh-huh. Is that right? Well, I hope all those filmmakers don't have any issues that would land them in immigration court, because there are a couple of judges who basically don't acknowledge or approve any asylum cases, and they have their percentages are below 5%, and so that's a very tough court. In contrast, for example, the court here in New York or in Los Angeles, there are a couple of places, Houston, where you have a much better chance.
Although it would depend on which judge I get.
It would depend on which judge you get, but for judges that are in the middle range on this, an honest, thoughtful, hardworking judge, there can be differences of opinion that are reasonable.
Let's talk about some of the people you've written about. Maria Arita, unlike many of the asylum seekers, she did find legal help.
Yes, and that was a case where she paid a fair amount of money. The lawyer, when the time came to actually take the case to before the judge and have what they called a merits hearing, her lawyer told her, well, I don't think we're going to succeed. And so she ended up going to the court by herself and ended up with an agreement to leave the country voluntarily. Now, this is a woman who her brother-in-law was killed by a gang, her father-in-law was killed by a gang, her husband was threatened by a gang, her children were threatened by a gang, another brother-in-law was shot but not killed. This woman had a lot to tell the judge, and she did eventually find a lawyer who managed to turn around that case.
But that first lawyer took her money and then didn't help her?
That's essentially what happened.
Did the courts take that into account?
I don't think so. In that case, the lawyer went through the proceedings, the process, the legal process for stepping out of the case, and she felt that she couldn't pay any more money. But she was lucky because she did find a lawyer who was willing to take the case for free.
What about the story of Torres Martinez?
Well, now, this is an interesting case. This is a woman who is from Mexico, and she... In contrast to what most Mexicans do, which is just try and cross the border illegally, she went to the port of entry and she presented herself and she asked for asylum because her youngest daughter was kidnapped by a narcotics gang in Mexico for reasons that are not entirely clear. But when she tried to get this child back, she found out that the police were also in collusion around this kidnapping with the drug traffickers. And she actually witnessed a scene where instead of a negotiation for the return of her young child, she saw the Mexican police giving money or receiving money. The money changed hands between the police and the drug traffickers. And so at that point, she felt that it would put her child's life in danger as in addition to her life if she continued to look for this child, and she fled to the United States. Now, she's
leaving the child.
Yes. She has another child who she needed to protect. And so she was in the situation when I found her of trying to figure out how she could get a lawyer. And she wasn't working, and she's raising a small child, and so this is a difficult situation in that region.
The Central American migrants have to travel through Mexico to get to the United States. Do they face danger in Mexico?
They do, very severe danger in Mexico, and a lot of them are not making it through Mexico anymore. The Mexican government has clamped down quite considerably on that on the transit of Central Americans. So they're stopping people at the southern border with Mexico, the border with Mexico and Guatemala. They are making it more difficult for people to get to the northern border. But in addition, the entire, the city of Reynosa, the Matamoros, which is south of Brownsville, many of these cities have now become controlled by feuding narcotics gangs in Mexico that are trying to combine the profits with their narcotics traffic with human smuggling.
These are the border towns. Very different Mexico than when you go to Mexico City or Oaxaca or Puebla.
Yes, very dangerous. From Reynosa, for example, I mean, just in recent times, another feud has broken out between narcotics cartels along that border, and it's just become incredibly dangerous for these migrants. They get abducted, they get beaten up, the women are threatened with sexual violence. It really has become very dangerous.
You previously wrote about President Trump's first roundups of deportees. What was the first roundup?
Well, so the Trump administration has not produced the 3 million deportations that President Trump announced right before the inauguration.
Could it?
Not at this point. But the pace of deportations has really accelerated very dramatically. And there are a couple of ways that that ICE is accomplishing that, ICE being Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So as I said before, used to be that under the Obama administration, there was much more focus within ICE on people who presented a threat to public safety, people with criminal records, people coming out of federal prison, that kind of thing. Now, all of those priorities have been eliminated, and the administration has made it clear that anyone who does not have legal immigration status can be subject to deportation. And lots of people who are just going about their business, working, agricultural fields, factories, restaurants, they are moving in on people. They're executing some old orders of removal that have been out there for many years. And they also will arrest anyone they encounter in the course of a search. Anyone who's not in immigration status will be arrested for deportation.
So conducting large sweeps of communities.
It's not really a sweep, I would say. It's more that they'll come with a warrant for one person, and they'll go into an apartment complex, for example. And then if that person isn't there, they'll start just questioning people in the parking lot or they'll wait, for example, people, if there's a carpool that's picking up immigrants to take them to a workplace, for example, they'll identify one person, and then they'll arrest everybody associated with that carpool.
Does DACA status offer any legal protection to people who are in the country illegally?
It does, yes. And there's a very important challenge to DACA that's coming forward here. So you have almost 800,000 young people who have received what's called DACA. This is not a lasting immigration status. These young people do not have immigration status. What they have is a reprieve from deportation. It's protection from deportation. And along with that, they get a work permit and a social security number. And even with that sort of minimal protection, these young people have gone to college, they've gotten jobs, they've studied for professional certificates, they've made extraordinary progress. I mean, this is a group of young people that are very deserving of the protection of the United States. I feel completely comfortable saying that.
Hasn't President Trump come to change his position on the Dreamers?
He has not. We don't know what his position is right now. What happened is that, led by Texas, a series of a number of conservative states have challenged the Justice Department to cancel this program before September 5th. And if the program is not canceled by September 5th, then these states are going to bring a lawsuit to attempt to get the program canceled. So President Trump is facing a moment of decision as to whether to defend the DACA program, extend the DACA program, what to do about this program.
What role is Attorney General Jeff Sessions playing in this new immigration policy?
Very consistently active. When Senator Sessions was in the Senate, he was the most outspoken immigration hawk in the Senate. He's deeply versed in immigration law and practice, and he has been encouraging the immigration courts, for example, to move deportations much more expeditiously. He has ordered federal prosecutors in every federal jurisdiction across the country to name a special, a particular prosecutor to bring immigration cases in federal court. So that's separate from immigration court. That you're talking about bringing felony cases against people in immigration for immigration violations.
What are border security coordinators?
Border security coordinators are, I believe, down in the jurisdictions along the border. They are people who are, I think, working with the Justice Department to coordinate these cases and decide when people should be subject to federal prosecution and that kind of thing.
Do you think that the president will be sending a message if he grants Joe Arpaio clemency?
Yes, very strong message. Joe Arpaio was found guilty of contempt of court. He hasn't even been sentenced yet. And this is a man whose hardline immigration policies really resonated in Arizona.
Julia Preston's article for the Washington Post and the Marshall Project is fearful of court. Asylum seekers are banished in absentia. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you.